Good morning. A new report from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration says military wives are more likely to binge drink and experience mental health issues than married women of the same age. Retired senior chief and now social worker Tony Chance compares the report to his experience in Hawaii. The story of Kainalo Young, who helped lead the Hawaiian Renaissance, comes to Hawaii International Film Festival screens. We'll talk about the nexus of modern Hawaiian history and politics with director-producer Marlene Booth. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkirk. Christy Passion has been described as a blue-collar poet. She'll read from her collection, Still Out of Place, live in our studio. And the intensity of classical Greek tragedy is brought to a modern setting in the St. Andrew's School production of Antigone Now.
It's Friday, November 4th. That's The Conversation, right after this news. Good morning and welcome to an Aloha Friday on The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Looking at the lives of military spouses.
And in a way that really hasn't been done before.
Yeah.
It's sort of been brought out more into the open and with a comparison of other people in same situations. We're going to talk about that new report first this morning. Now, you know that life for a military spouse isn't easy, and weathering deployments, frequent single parenthood, and loneliness can take its toll. A new report from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration compared the mental illness experiences and drinking habits of military wives ages 18 to 49 with married women in general of the same age. The survey found that an almost 10% higher incidence of mental health challenges and binge drinking among the military wives. Tony Chance is a retired Navy senior chief and now a social worker with Child and Family Service, and he's had a look at the report, and he joins us in our studio this morning. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You have personal experience with this, and now you have professional experience with this. For everyone else who's sort of been on the outside of the military bubble, there are things that we think we understand or know about what a military family goes through. But we don't really seem to understand it at the depth that we've seen it happen outside, where there's been more studies that permeate the general news cycle. But this one seems to be very interesting because it's the first time that those questions from the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration were added into the National Survey on Drug Use and Health.
When I read the report, I was shocked. And it's something that always has been there throughout the years. But I think with the advent of the new technology, social media, more information getting out into the public, that the substance abuse, the powers that be noticed that this is a population that we need to look at because it's being overrepresented to the national averages.
The interesting thing was that the drug of choice seemed to be alcohol. Now, when you look at kids, and this survey also looked at kids, although we're not expressly talking about that today, there were other drugs of choice. But for the military spouses, 80% of them were women. The drug of choice seemed to be alcohol. Very clearly accessible. I mean, you go over to the NEX and there's, the package store and there's full of all kinds of great stuff at great prices. No big surprise there?
No big surprise. You know, alcohol is the drug of choice because being in the military, everybody in the military is so scrutinized for illicit drugs. You know, we do have our illicit drugs, very small percentage, but the one that we do have the most of, and you're absolutely correct, it is easily available and ready and very cheap.
And socially acceptable.
And socially acceptable. And sometimes, there's been campaigns in the past to reduce that socially acceptable idea of alcohol, but it hasn't slowed down. And obviously with this report, you can see that it's either ramping up.
Although they looked at military wives who are ages 18 to 49, most of them skewed younger. And when you think about the life of a young military wife who is now, you know, married to someone who is coming and going, potentially could be having children, having those responsibilities, and is very, very far in a lot of cases from a family circle and from that support that she had, you know, going into the marriage. These things seem not to be well taken into account, despite the fact that there are support groups on base and whatnot, that we don't really understand that, at least on the outside as well. Is it well or better understood on the inside?
It is, but it's difficult to root out because of the fact that the spouses of a military member are very aware that if anything was to come out in the public, if they were to go ask for help, that they themselves or their spouse, military spouse, could hurt their career. And so a lot of these are unfounded. It's just those urban myths that are there that, if I go ask for help or, ask for any kind of help, that it could hurt my husband or wife's career in the military. Those are myths. But there are those, you do hear those stories, so.
Myths, but ones that have been perpetuated in some part by military spouses who, for years, when perhaps there wasn't as much help as there is now, were basically, telling each other to suck it up because they were in the military too. Why is that not changing, despite the fact that there, seems to be a lot more help available? And also, as you say, this is really a myth that it's going to hurt a spouse's career.
Well, the frame of mind, it used to be an old school of thought, and we've always joked about it throughout the years, but it's still a component of the military. When you join the military, your superiors would say your family wasn't issued in your sea bag or your duffel bag. It didn't come with you, so you're the main focus. The family, the military family is just separate. They didn't come with you. Well, that sometimes that culture is still there throughout certain commands and stuff. So they're always looked at as the outsider, where they should be looked at as a whole, as a one unit.
That holistic view that you're talking about is one that we've heard of more in recent times. But as you are now a social worker dealing with families here who are trying to cope with a lot of these issues, both in and out of the military, how relevant is this study to what you're seeing when you go to visit these families?
Well, it's very relevant because there's some common issues. Every individual who abuses any type of drugs does it for a uniquely special reason to them, whatever that is. But there are some common underlying things like trauma, past traumas in their lives, the inability to process certain things, how to process anger, how to process frustration with trying to be a mom, a wife, a best friend, someone to the community. And with little to no training, these spouses are told to do that.
So do you think then that spouses need to have, in fact, some real training coming into the military as well as understanding that they're marrying into it, they've also become it? I mean, we hear things about, we're a military family. I've had families say that to me. But how that translates into how they manage their family life and their interpersonal relationships as husband and wife or spouses gets to be a little dicey sometimes when that person comes back and is, as you say, traumatized.
Absolutely. And then when when the spouse is home, taking care of, they have children, or even if they don't have children, they have to take care of the home life. That's their job. But now the element, their spouse comes back, they have this trauma of, sometimes PTSD or some form of PTSD, some form of mental illness, head injury, CTE, the new thing. And now these wives, instead of raising just what they know, now they have another element. And so when you think about it, they're the unsung heroes. actually.
What difference do you think this report's going to make?
I think it's going to open a lot of eyes. I hope it will. You know, it opened my eyes, even though I was in it. You don't really see it until you step back and look at the numbers, and statistics tell a part of the story. They don't tell the whole story, but they tell they're meant to do just what they did. They're meant to open your eyes and start asking questions.
Well, Tony, thank you for coming in this morning. Good to talk to you again.
Thank you so much.
Tony Chance retired from the Navy as a senior chief in 2012 after 22 years of service. He spent 3 years stationed in Hawaii, working regularly with hundreds of service members and their families. He became a social worker and now works with Child and Family Services and the First District Family Court in Kapolei. And if you'd like to have a look at the report, you can do that on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's 8:14, and coming up in the show, Christy Passion's new collection of poems, Still Out of Place. But first, your quiz.
Later in the show, we'll talk about a documentary exploring the life of an acclaimed Hawaiian scholar and activist. Documentaries are a powerful tool, combining the depth and research of a book with the multi-sensory experiences of film. Hawaii has been the subject of many a documentary, often exploring the geography and natural beauty of the islands. However, one prominent documentary film explores the life and times of Queen Liliuokalani, the sovereign of the Kingdom of Hawaii during the overthrow. That documentary was produced by PBS and chronicles the Queen's life from childhood to the overthrow. Today, we're looking for that film's name. Call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right gets an HPR goodie.
Good morning. I'm Victor Gemignani from the Hawaii Appleseed Center for Law and Economic Justice. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Poems are undervalued as chronicles of everyday life, and the things we see and hear around us and frequently take for granted can be woven into poetry by the careful observer. Christy Passion's poems are built on just that kind of detailed observation, which through its precision invites us to look more closely at our world. And she's with us this morning with her new collection of poems called Still Out of Place. Good morning, Christy.
Morning. Aloha.
What does it take? I mean, this is an unfair question. What does it take to be a poet?
To be really present. I think that is the first and foremost thing, because you are going to be writing about things, even if it's in your memory, you have to look at it as objectively as you can and then interject emotion versus the other way around.
You start with the just the facts.
Yes. And then you move into... There will always be a heart to a poem. There's a reason why you want to write a piece.
Right.
I think that's probably true of all writing. And that comes from the heart. But for me to convey that to someone without it being brash, over the top, I have to control it. So you have to remove that piece. Start with the objective and what is the image that's going to go along with that heart. And then make sure that the words are letting your reader know who you're trying to convey, what is the heart of your poem.
if those words are accurate enough, detailed enough, mm-hmm. the emotion will inevitably follow, yeah?
Usually, yeah. A lot of my work here will talk about growing up in Hawaii, which is not your typical visions of Hawaii. It's not the beaches and it's not palm trees and
sun, sand, and surf.
The tourist views of it, which is Hawaii, no doubt.
Yeah.
But it's very different when you're a mother and father working two jobs just to make the rent.
Sure.
That's Hawaii, too. And from that image will come what I'm trying to tell you.
I think a lot of us who live here feel that our story is not getting told the way we live it.
Yeah.
That's kind of what seems to be driving you in a lot of ways.
Absolutely. I think there's beauty in the darker parts of Hawaii. I think that it needs to be said without... There's this... I know we have this incredible homelessness problem. And while we as a society want to take care of it and want to, I wouldn't say abolish it, but fix this problem.
Yeah.
One-to-one... People will say, not in my neighborhood. One-to-one, when you come across a homeless person, there's instinctually fear and judgment.
Right.
I think if you look at it, and if you're living here, you know someone that's homeless. You know that's your cousin. You know that you are 2 months away from losing the rent. Mm-hmm. When you can speak to that truth and put it out there, that resonates. And that overcomes some of this this generalized fear. And then it makes it more human. It makes ourselves more human.
That particular truth embodies a contradiction, which you just spoke of, the mm-hmm. whole, isn't it terrible that these people are suffering, and yet you recoil when you see someone on the street.
Yeah. I think my job as a nurse allows me to traverse that a little more easily because I come into close contact with the ugly, the sick, the dying daily. So it's not a foreign place for me to walk that place to not recoil, but greet with compassion.
And you're a critical care nurse, which means you get called when things are really dire.
Yeah, when it's really, really bad.
And that's your daily bread.
Yeah. Seeing me means your day is not going well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what does it do for your day, I guess, is the question that might be asked about that.
I take pride, I actively am involved with all of the seven deadly sins. And as far as pride is concerned, I take pride in my skills as a critical care nurse.
Mm-hmm.
I know when things are going bad that I have the years, the experience, the knowledge to take care of that critical moment. So there is definite pride in that. When I'm seeing something go downhill fast, you're in respiratory distress, you're having a heart attack, and I know what to do to stop it, mm-hmm. to turn it around, I feel great about that. But more than that is these moments that are not going to be written in the chart of when I can sit with you and hold your hand till your daughter comes because you're afraid in the ER and you're alone. That equally gives me pride, but that's something a lot of nurses will go through but will not talk about.
It also gives you access to life at those extremely dire moments when it's slipping away.
Yeah, exactly.
And you've expressed that very honestly in some of your work as well.
Yeah, yeah. A few of the poems, Mercy, and some of the poems are about my father dying. He was this a big moke of a man, my father, and mm-hmm. that's how he grew up. He was not one to say words like I love you, but he was one to show an action.
Mm-hmm.
Your typical old school style of man. So when he died and going through the process of cancer with him, that was a big learning curve for me because I'm trying to treat him as I would a patient, and he would not be treated as a patient.
Mm-hmm.
I was first and foremost his daughter, and that was the tough point.
And you've written about that.
Yeah, yeah.
Could you read that passage we were talking about?
Sure. It comes from the poem called To the End, and I'm going to skip to the part that will speak to that message of control. As a critical care nurse, it's all about control in our environment. I control the ventilator, so I control your breathing. I control your medications. I control when you eat. I control when you get out of bed. There's a lot of control. And then I'm hitting this force, which is my father, who will not be controlled. And I learned that at the very end, he didn't need me to be a nurse. He needed me to be his daughter.
Yeah.
So the lines, I'm starting off towards the end of the poem and to the end. My arrogance in the papers I signed, the pills I counted out, the way I explained it to you as gospel, but you didn't need church. You needed me to throw stones with you, to walk alongside you to the muddy edge, your life threaded through your own jaw and bear witness as you clamped down. How alive you were as the cancer closed in. How terrified I was. And that speaks to me trying to just control that piece and actually being just terrified that I'm losing my father.
And yet, I think a lot of people at the end find a healing in a kind of rage at the dying of the light, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Was that what it was for him?
He fought to the bitter end. But I think he could accept that his death, we were in his bedroom, surrounded by his family. His grandson is massaging his feet. He had his jazz records on. He was on 800 thread count sheets. He was, and I was telling him he couldn't speak at that point anymore, but I was telling him I was going to take care of Mom. He didn't need to worry. He can let go. And I think that's the kind of death we can all hope for.
Exactly.
A dignified death surrounded by people you love.
Can't really ask for much more, can you,
Christy? Not too much.
Thanks so much for telling us about
that. Thank you. Yeah.
It's wonderful to hear just a sample of your work, which is really some lovely work.
Thanks
so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Christy Passion is the author of Still Out of Place, her debut collection of poems. She'll be reading from her work at Kapi'olani Community College's Lama Library Alcove on Thursday, November 10th at 9:15. You can link to some of her poems through our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Matson, completing the 15th year of their Kaipu Aina program, partnering with charities that clean litter from our islands, shores, and parks. Learn more at matson.com/foundation.
Clinton and Trump supporters are making some noise in Hawaii. But is their get-out-to-vote message making a difference or just making them feel better? Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning. Happy Aloha Friday.
You too. So part of this is what happened last week in Waikiki when a number of Trump supporters sort of spontaneously decided to drive down and make their presence known. And then, you know, others are saying, well, okay, is that really going to do anything to get out the vote? Or is it just simply a matter of, you know, people making their own choices known?
You know, the news is dominated by what's going on in the swing states, right? Florida, North Carolina, Nevada, and the polls indicate the race is tightening nationally, although it seems like Clinton still has the edge over Trump. But the supporters for both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump here locally think that, you know, don't forget us, too. There's actually a lot of excitement, particularly among the Trump supporters. Remember, they prevailed in the GOP caucus back in March, defeating Marco Rubio, a much more establishment candidate. Jeb Bush was favored by a lot of the party elders here, but he didn't even make it out of the primaries to get to Hawaii. So there's a sense that, you know, Hawaii matters too, and that spontaneous parade, mini parade in down Kalakaua Avenue was an expression of that. By the way, I actually happened to be there at the time, and it was amazing to see all these tourists turning their heads and seeing people waving American flags and shouting out for Trump.
Maybe not a sight they expected to see in Waikiki, but as we look at this sort of with the greater context, on one hand, you could say, you know, is it going to matter in the way the state may vote? Because clearly we're not a swing state. Clearly there,
right,
as we have talked about before, not a lot of controversy surrounding how this state's going to go. But for someone who wants to get out and feel like he or she is freely and hopefully appropriately expressing his or her political views, this seems to be a little bit of a different taste for Hawaii than we've had of that before.
Well, just a little quick context. Remember that Hawaii did vote Republican back in 1972. That was Richard Nixon. We did go for Ronald Reagan in 1984. even in 2004, Dick Cheney flew out here, the vice president, spoke at the Hawaii Convention Center, but of course John Kerry ended up winning that year. Remember also that Hillary Clinton's support was soft in the presidential preference poll back in March. Bernie Sanders defeated her 2-1. So, yes, we may not make a difference when it comes to the Electoral College, but there is a sense that you can send a message to Washington. Remember, Barack Obama was born here.
All right. Well, that message bit has been kind of resounding in different parts and different places. Does this mean that we're going to see, you know, more of these kinds of activities, do you think, or was this a more of a one-off?
I think there'll be more. There actually are a number of examples of sign waving that have been held around the state, a lot of rallies. They're staffing phone banks, canvassing door-to-door. This is both the Clinton and Trump campaigns. Remember, each party had these rousing debate parties as well back when Trump and Clinton were going at it. So I don't think it's a one-off thing. I think people are aggressively trying to get registered. I know I spoke to a Democratic operative in charge, and he says, we're taking this very seriously. And remember, when Democrats turn out to vote, they win in Hawaii because historically we're such a blue state. But I tell you, the Trump folks are really fired up.
Well, and we've seen them in different places around town and sort of like places where you might not expect to see them. But some of those activities that you mentioned are ones that we've seen before, but not necessarily people just spontaneously creating a parade down Kalakaua Avenue. That'll be interesting to see whether that kind of thing takes hold, too. Thanks. Have a good weekend. We're going to talk to you on Monday.
You too. Thanks, Bethann.
Oh, yeah. 4 or 5 more days to go. Chad Blair joins us every day from Civil Beat with a reality check. And after that look of international news, we're going to take a real quick view of what's coming out of our newsroom come next week. A pivotal week, a momentous week, but it's not all about elections, Bill Dorman.
It's true. But, it starts with the elections, maybe. So Tuesday night, we'll be here. Wayne Yoshioka heading up the coverage on the air. I'll join him if I can be helpful. But Wayne heading things up. We'll be dipping into jazz, evening jazz with Charles Huston as the evening goes on and updates as we get them. Of course, NPR's election coverage is going to be part of that as well. And then we'll follow the fallout, wherever that may lead for the rest of the week.
As will a lot of us. But in looking at things other than the election, because for a lot of people who have said, okay, enough already.
Right.
I need
something
to show me another slice of life.
Yeah.
The idea of Hawaiian Sign Language?
Yeah, so this is interesting. This is something different than ASL, the American Sign Language, that what people may be familiar with, the alphabet with your hands and different signing for actions of different kinds. There's an entirely separate system of Hawaiian Sign Language. And Noe Tanigawa is going to take a look at not just what that is, but also where that came from and a bit of where it's going as well.
We may need some video with that one. Yeah. Also, a check-in of the Hokulea this week?
Sure. Still in dry dock on the East Coast, but action is afoot. A new crew is going to be rotating in. They're looking to get back out on the water and head down the coast of Florida. Molly Solomon is going to check in with one of the crew members. And meanwhile, the crew members have been named among National Geographic's 2017 Adventurers of the Year. 10 finalists on this, so you can vote. You can vote for the home team. You can find out more at their website, hokulea.com.
Oh, wow. That sounds really compelling.
Yeah, cheer for the home team.
Yeah, that home team. But while you're talking about teams, what about the Molokai football team?
Yeah, really. Go Farmers. So this is the 8-man team that just won the Maui Interscholastic League title. But the story behind the team is really quite something. For more than 50 years, there was no high school football in Molokai. And it's largely, as so many things are, individuals taking action, rallying some things. In this case, the coach putting some things together, a longer journey involving convincing, fundraising, persuasion, blocking and tackling along the way as well. But Catherine Kluett-Pachtel of the Molokai Dispatch putting together a longer look at the team, and we'll hear from that.
All right. Good stuff coming out of the newsroom next week.
Thanks
for the preview.
You bet.
Every Friday, Bill Dorman joins us with a look at what's happening in our HPR newsroom and what we can see when here the following week.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Bush Consulting and Sacred Hearts Academy.
Hawaiian scholar and activist Kainalu Young helped lead the Hawaiian Renaissance and was a founding faculty member of the UH School of Hawaiian Studies. At the age of 15, he'd become wheelchair-bound after a diving accident, and although he died in 2008 at age 54, his life and legacy continue to inspire and guide generations. His story comes to Hawaii International Film Festival screens starting next week. Filmmaker Marlene Booth has both directed and produced the film. She's in our studio with us this morning. Good morning.
Hello, Beth Ann. Thanks for having me.
Nice to talk to you. I mean, we often see that the documentaries are bringing in the world of politics and history, and there's, you know, such a nexus of art and, you know, cultural impulse, and what many people would say is, you know, what we're also dealing with in how we approach the world in, you know, civil liberties and
right.
all of that. That now is being told, not necessarily just within the context of news stories, but within film. For you, it seems that Kainalu Young was quite a pivotal figure and changed your direction and your viewpoints in some ways. How did that happen?
Well, I met Kainalu actually when I first came here. We sat on a panel together judging film proposals for Pacific Islanders and Communications, and we clicked and talked about making a film together. And that ended up becoming a film that was finished in 2008, unfortunately, after Kainalu passed away, about Pidgin English in Hawaii, called Pidgin, the Voice of Hawaii. But Kainalu's influence on me was major. He took a risk, I think, on this Haole lady from the mainland, and he really opened doors for me. He insisted wisely that I sit in on his Hawaiian 107 class to bring an understanding of history to current Hawaiian issues. And that was always important to him. It was also always important to him to bring in evidence and to be able, as a scholar and as a human being, to change his mind about things.
After having had that experience, where did that take you next? I know you had talked about doing Pidgin and you did that film together, but right. it seemed that was a real departure for you. I mean, as you talk about being a Haole woman from the mainland and trying to understand those nuances about Hawaii that don't show up in picture postcards,
right.
that don't, you know, come right. with all of the tourist information that people give you.
Right.
That's based in the real life for a lot of people who have lived here for generations.
Right. I wouldn't have come up with a topic like Pidgin on my own. It was a topic that Kainalu introduced. And it was intriguing to me because here was someone who was pivotal in the Hawaiian sovereignty movement, in the birth of Hawaiian studies, who deeply loved the Hawaiian language, and for whom Hawaiian history was a reason to recommit to life after the trauma of his accident. Why was he saying that we should make a film about Pidgin? But that came for him from a deep understanding and love of his multicultural family, and feeling as though he said to me, "Pidgin, without Pidgin, I would cease to be whole." So he was also always looking at wholeness within the context of Hawaii and how to get there and how to bring, especially, Native Hawaiians with him.
That sense of wholeness for the Hawaiian people seems to also be branching out into a wholeness for Hawaii in general. This film that you've made now that tells his story shows us a very, very different Hawaii and a different take on American history.
Yes.
How much of this do you think is going to be able to be that pivotal point for somebody else in the way that Kainalu Young was for you?
One never knows about the impact of a film on an audience or on an audience member. one of the things that was most important to me about this film was to have it be a look at a certain period of Hawaiian history and attitudes toward Hawaiians in this archipelago of a certain time, and see it through the lens of one individual. How did that history shape this young man, who then became a major Hawaiian scholar and an activist? And how does history act on each one of us? What is our own? We're not immune from it. We respond to our times. How did he respond to his times? In what ways was that individually important? And how does someone looking at the film see themselves and their own lives through it?
And what about the impact of the politics on our times? Because very clearly some of the same issues that are shown in the film that he wrestled with, that he tried to bring to the forefront back in the day, are still issues that we wrestle with here.
Absolutely. I think his sense was that these things are not ever solved once and for all, and that there's no one voice within the Hawaiian community. There are many voices. There are many things happening. And I think he would say this is a process of a people, a nation, the intersection of those people, that nation, all of us with history, and we'll see where we are and how things shake out.
The Hawaiian Renaissance galvanized perspectives.
Yes.
He was one of those people who helped that happen. As this film is now coming to screens through HIFF and potentially through other festivals too, is this also becoming pivotal in shaping a new Hawaiian Renaissance? Do you see that happening as you've been talking to people and as, you know, the legacy and legend of Kanaloa Young continues to grow?
I haven't yet shown it to vast audiences, so it's hard to know. And one hopes it will be on public television as well, ultimately. I think there, you know, many of the issues that affected Kanaloa, like the rebirth of Hawaiian and how important the Hawaiian language was to him in his knowing himself and knowing through that language this place and the history of this place. In a lot of ways, there's been great success with it. There are Hawaiian immersion schools, many, many, many Hawaiian language classes in the UH system. And in some ways, I know he saw, because we talked about this, younger Hawaiians didn't live through the struggles he lived through to become the Hawaiian man he became. So I hope it opens up an appreciation for that history so that people can begin to look back and sort of understand that 40 years ago, there were not immersion schools. There were not always Hawaiian language signs around. There was not a Hawaiian word of the day on HPR. There may not have been an HPR, but things have changed. And I think it's important for people to remember the origins of that change.
And very often when a generation hasn't gone through that struggle and takes certain things for granted, some of the things you just mentioned,
yeah,
it may be more difficult to access that. But sometimes there's that pivotal something that happens that becomes the spark for further self-discovery. We'll see,
yes,
if that happens with your film. I wish you all the best.
Thank you so much. Take care.
And you too. Marlene Booth is the director and the producer of Kukanaka, which will be screening at the Hawaii International Film Festival next week. We'll have all of the screen times on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
Aloha, I'm David Ulrich from Pacific New Media, University of Hawaii. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Twitter. Talk back to your radio at HIConversation.
Helping people.
Made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want to do.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. Okahau ka'aina keola o ka poi means the breath of the land is the life of the people. Oahu's Kalihi Valley Nature Preserve is a place where people come to renew their link between the health of the land and the well-being of the people. This isn't something that most of us are aware of these days. In fact, the majority of city dwellers behave as though we're separate from the land. But every now and then, the earth gives us a big slap to remind us that we are a part of nature, and therefore, it's impossible for us to exist outside of it. A grant from the Hawaii Tourism Authority enables the Mamakakahu Project to teach future leaders, using traditional Hawaiian practices, to kindle awareness of the importance of our connection with the land. These leaders are taught with the expectation that it is their responsibility to spread this knowledge to the next generations. The Kalihi Valley Nature Preserve, a place of learning, renewal, and preservation. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we ask you to give us the name of a PBS documentary exploring the life and times of Queen Liliuokalani. It was first released in 1982 as part of the PBS series American Experience, and American Experience has covered nearly 400 years of American history, from the arrival of the Pilgrims to the modern environmental movement. The series has done biographies of presidents, industrialists, and cultural figures, but Liliuokalani has the distinction of being both the only monarch and the only Hawaiian subject of the show. Her documentary spotlights the life of a woman far ahead of her Western peers. She dined at the White House, was received at Buckingham Palace, and organized Hawaii against a smallpox outbreak at a time when women in the West were largely relegated to domestic roles. The name of that documentary is American Experience, Hawaii's Last Queen. And sadly, nobody got that. So at 8:47, that's today's quiz. And if you've got a quiz for us, you can always send it to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Classical Greek tragedies are at the root of so much of contemporary storytelling, conjuring up a picture of humans whose fate is ruled by fickle gods. The Greeks explained life's unpredictable nature by thinking of gods as prey to the same volatile emotions and unpredictable actions as the people they control. Antigone Now, a contemporary adaptation of Sophocles' play Antigone, brings an old story to a modern setting as it keeps its themes intact. Claire Fallon is the director of theater, elementary music, and movement at St. Andrew's School, and the school's student production of Antigone Now opens tonight. Claire is with us this morning. Good morning, Claire.
Good morning.
And you've been prey to the actions of the fickle gods very recently, haven't you?
Oh, yes. Last night there was a theater accident.
Because you came in this morning on crutches because you've got a nasty torn ligament. So thanks so much for being here.
The show must go on.
Show must go on. It's your living proof. What is it that drew you to this particular show? And we should probably kind of sum up a little bit of the story to set the stage.
Definitely. So it is about Oedipus just happened before that. So he married his mother and he killed his father, and then he realized and pulled out his eyes and he died. And so his children take over, and then the two sons kill each other. So this is where our show starts. Antigone wants to bury one
She's
of her.
She's the older daughter of two?
She's the younger, actually.
Younger daughter.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And she wants to bury her brother, and the king has said, no, you're not. The new king, her uncle, Creon, said, no, don't touch him because he's a villain.
And he's been dishonored.
He's been dishonored, yeah. Because he attacked the city. They wouldn't give. That's a whole political thing. And Antigone says, it's the right thing to bury my brother. And Creon says, no. I'm the new king. You have to do what I say. And I say no. And she doesn't buy that. And she said, I'm going to do it. And I'm going to take the consequences, whatever they are. and her sister Ismene begs her not to do it, begs her not to do it, and then she, when she does do it and gets condemned to death, Ismene wants to die with her, and
so a young woman defies some very strict social rules, conventions.
Yes.
By following her own lights as to what is right or wrong.
Exactly.
When the environment and even the authority figures around her are absolutely forbidding that action.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the skeleton of the story that translates to modern times, yeah?
Yes. And this story was used in World War II in resistance to the Nazis, mm-hmm. Talking about internal referencing and how we need to know and do what we really feel is right instead of what the institution and what the people around us are saying, which I feel like is such a wonderful message at this day and time for us to really feel at what is right for us to be doing instead of just blindly following along.
Well, when you take external rules of right and wrong, the motives for which those rules are established are suspect, right? Because mm-hmm. they might be motives that have nothing to do with right and wrong.
Right. Greed or power, ego, all mm-hmm. of those things can lead. And another reason why I chose this show is because I feel like it's completely appropriate for the coming election, right? We have a woman who is for the first time, and when Sophocles wrote this, women weren't powerful.
Yeah.
So, and this was really important for Sophocles to write. It was his first one in the trilogy that he actually wrote, and it was a woman standing up for the first time against this like male patriarchy domination. And so we have our Creon has been studying Donald Trump. Like his speeches, and you'll even see aspects of that in the show of him. There's a scene where he's standing with his arms crossed behind Antigone for a whole part of it, and
it might easily remind you
yeah.
of images that you've seen.
Exactly. Yeah.
In what we've seen in the public arena, there's an awful lot of male versus female
mm-hmm.
in the discussion. I think that that the whole notion is being challenged now that it needs a man to run the military, that
right.
kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, don't you think a lot of those attitudes that have been sort of simmering below the surface have been brought up by having a woman running for president?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I feel like that this happening is painful to watch and to experience, but I think it can be a blessing too, because it's bringing these, as you're saying, these issues that have been under wraps, and it's exposing that this is still happening and that this is that, you know, the yeah. Yes, exactly.
Well, because, the whole thing about Greek tragedy is it's so incredibly intense. I mean, mm-hmm. Oedipus doesn't just die, he plucks out his eyes, and the actions of so many Greek tragedies are just hideous, and they don't end, they don't have happy endings. You don't ride off into the sunset. So mm-hmm. so why Greek tragedy? What does that kind of theater give us?
Well, I think that it gives us a chance to address issues that we can't bring up at our local like get-togethers or community and potluck, and it's a chance to talk about things and to bring up questions that can be uncomfortable to talk about but mm-hmm. can be really important to think about. And my hope is that it will expand people's minds and open up with more questions. And actually, the end of this story is hopeful. Spoiler alert, Antigone does die, but most people probably know that.
Yeah. Don't go expecting a Greek tragedy, right?
But the last moment of the show is the sister Ismene. So Antigone has made the path. She's dug that trench for the women to come behind her to stand up and to do what they feel is right. And Ismene has this moment of hope where she says, I'm going to continue to live because I want to see it and I want to continue on. And so it's, I think that that's the part of the modern take on it, is that she wants to leave us with this moment of hope. And I love that, this version, because of that.
Yeah. Certainly is a powerful message, Claire.
Thank you.
What an
yeah.
ambitious production.
yeah.
Take care of that bum ankle.
I will. Thank you.
Great to have you on the show.
Wonderful being here.
Claire Fallon is the director of theater, elementary music, and movement at St. Andrew's School, and the school's student production of Antigone Now, a contemporary adaptation of Sophocles' play, opens tonight, runs through Saturday at Tenney Theater in downtown Honolulu. Details and showtimes are on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from First Insurance Company of Hawaii, providing auto insurance since 1911, committed to delivering personal attention and expert advice. First Insurance Company of Hawaii, FICOH.com.
You know, Greek theater endures in part, I think, because of what Claire was saying to us about that it fearlessly goes at the things that make us uncomfortable.
And that make us human.
Yeah, exactly. Frequently, which are frequently the same things, right?
And timeless.
Yeah, exactly. But her whole, the way I think she conceives this particular production, Antigone Now, in terms of the role of women today, seems right on point to me.
And I think it seems right on point to a lot of the women who are involved with it, too. And what they do with that lesson is they move through their lives. You know, we all have these reflection points, and you see where that moves you in a certain direction. We were talking to Marlene Booth when she had that first conversation sitting on a panel with Kanalu Young.
Right.
There is something that sometimes just shoots you off into a different direction. Sometimes that can be what happens when you're in a play.
Exactly. I'm going to hang on to that inspiration.
That's going to do it for us for this week. Next week, that's a big week coming up. And on Monday, we're going to sit down with producer-director Caleb McManahan, talking about his documentary, Ties That Bind Hawaii in the Pacific, looking at Hawaii fisheries.
And Lee Cataluna will be here to talk about her new children's book.
And we didn't even mention the election. Oh, yeah, there is that, too. All that's happening next week. And in the meantime, we'd like to hear from you, and you can call our talkback line anytime you like. Here's the number. It's 808-792-8217, or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or you can tweet us at HI Conversation, or find me at BKOZHPR.
And if you've ever found yourself wondering about the music you hear on the show, you can always find our playlist on our page at hawaiipublicradio.org, which is where you can also hear podcasts of today's shows and past shows. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Kosovich.
And Lillian Song produces the program. Ryan Finnerty, Russell Subiono are our production assistants.
Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello, and I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kosovich. We'll see you on Monday and pick up the conversation. Have a great weekend.